plate a potential nugget.
Just to maybe get the framework, fleshed out a little bit. You in the book, you talk about the trade-off between time poverty and money poverty, which I found interesting. You know, people struggle to plot it on the same scale, and you've sort of taken a stab at how do we really attach a money value to time, and how do we think about that trade-off? And you actually say something interesting in the book. You say that money protects us against sadness, but doesn't necessarily buy happiness. I found that quite intriguing. So give us a sense of how we should think about this trade-off and what's the insight here.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning before, what's really interesting is that as we gain more wealth, as we make more money, we should be able to outsource more. We should have more control over our schedules at work and outside of it. Maybe we should be allocated more paid vacation. So by a function of some of these assumptions, we should also feel happier and more time affluent. But what large panel survey data shows is that people who make more money are more stressed, in part because they become even more focused on making and earning money. They work more. They're more likely to spend their time engaged in activities that promote time poverty and stress, like working and commuting. So this data that you're talking about, In my research and others, there's kind of two numbers. So you wrote this out, and I think it's useful to kind of think about, is past $60,000 US of income, more money doesn't necessarily drive more happiness. And actually, once you start making more than $100,000, what's really interesting is you start feeling worse off because you start comparing yourself to others. So actually hitting that milestone that you have in your mind of how much money you want to make post-graduation, you think you're going to stop and focus on leisure or family once you hit that number. But actually what starts to happen is you focus on work and money to an even greater extent. You start comparing yourself to people who have even more money than you. And that's part of the reason that I talk about this in the book, that chasing wealth is a time trap. Because we tell ourselves going into our careers, once I hit a certain promotion, once I hit a certain rank, once I hit a certain salary number, a certain amount in the bank, a certain proportion of my mortgage that's paid off, I'm going to stop and I'm going to scale back. But what often happens is we stop and our reference point changes and we go after the even higher promotion or the even higher salary band at the expense of our time. And this is where the data gets interesting. So there's a lot of good research now by Kostad and Kushlev at Georgetown and others showing that the amount of income we make can protect against sadness. When we make more money, we're better able to manage the demands that come up in everyday life. When our car breaks down, we can easily pay to fix it or replace the car. So these everyday shocks that happen to us don't impact our emotions to the same extent as negative. We don't feel as much negative emotion to the same extent. However, income does not translate into greater happiness because a lot of the factors that drive happiness, social connection, meaningful interactions with people we care about, volunteering, physical activity, cooking, hobbies, religious participation, all of these fundamental ingredients of what it means to live a happy and meaningful life involve our time. But when we work all the time, when we're chasing the next promotion, we don't have the time or bandwidth to spend in activities that are likely to promote our own and our loved ones' happiness. So this is where we start getting into this conversation around time and money trade-offs. I've also done a lot of research on this question, looking at the extent to which we're willing to give up money to have more free time or give up time in order to have more money. And what's, of course, obvious or should be evident from this conversation is people who are willing to give up their free time in order to work and earn more money, regardless of how much income they have, regardless of their savings, report less happiness, more stress, worse social relationships. They spend less time engaged in exercise. They spend less time in hallway conversations with colleagues because they treat every interaction more instrumentally. And so overall, this focus on money at the expense of free time starts chipping away at our satisfaction because it makes us feel more stressed and less connected to those around us.
Hmm. And coming back to the two numbers, Ashley, you say that post of course, these numbers are indicative, and I don't want us to take it literally. But just to get the just to get the logic here, post 100,000 US, you say that the goalpost shifts and we start comparing ourselves to others, and therefore we end up working more and therefore becoming more time poor. Could you expand a little bit more about what happens between 60 and 100? What changes at 60 when you say that beyond that, the money doesn't seem to drive more happiness?
I mean, research is still out on this question, but the global data suggests all over the world, and we put it into the US currency just for the purpose of illustration. I think you're exactly right. We should not take this literally. This is really just figurative, a general trend in the data. But there's a U-shape. So in general, more income is sort of predicting happiness. Then you hit that plateau point, $60,000, say. And then actually happiness starts decreasing. So you get this S shape in the data. And then it goes back up once you're at the top rank of the income distribution. And so it has to, part of the psychological underpinnings that researchers are speculating on but are still trying to figure out is your reference points change. So social comparison processes are critical for happiness. And once we make it in a certain point in our career, our reference points might shift as we get older, as we work our way up in our career. And that is one of the explanations, are reference points changing. We feel lower in rank on the income distribution because we're comparing ourselves to a different distribution than we did before. That's one of the explanations for this dip as you start to make more money. It's not until you get to the top of your social referent category that you start seeing the happiness dividends again pay off for people at the highest level of the income distribution. But it, as per our conversation, there are many factors. Again, it could be more work demands. It could be more difficult personal relationships as you start working and earning and making more money. It could be an increase in materialism, which we know can undermine our happiness. And materialism is the enjoyment of things and acquisition, which could actually push us to even have to change our reference points because we've acquired a mortgage, we've acquired a car that needs to be paid. And so as a function of this, we have to work more and earn more. And so that overall, that logic is why my colleagues and I talk about the pursuit of wealth for wealth itself or wealth's sake can be a happiness trap that makes us feel time poor and feel like we need even more money than we have or that we've made to be happier in the future.
That's a great point. I guess at some level you're saying there's a non-monetary cost of acquiring more money that we don't account for in the pursuit of...
So this is exactly, and this is a really important point that I'm really trying to emphasize in the book, is that often we make major life decisions, and there's good research on this by Caitlin Woolley and her colleagues at Cornell, showing that when we're on the outside of a decision, what career do I choose? Where do I live? We're focused on the extrinsic. We're focused on how much money can I make? What's the prestige of this job? How much house can I buy for as little of my money as possible? And we often discount intrinsic motivators or other factors like time when it comes to our career. We underestimate the extent that intrinsic motivation, how happy we feel when we're doing our job, matters. And when it comes to major life decisions, we also discount the time cost of living in a bigger place further from away from our place of employment. So in general, we're not very good at making these kind of time and money trade-offs. We're very good at carefully accounting for our finances and making decisions on objective metrics like money. And we're much less good at considering these non-financial, these intangible costs or benefits of our major life decisions. And that's where a lot of my research fits, is saying these minor decisions that we make on an everyday basis, spending hours researching to find the cheapest deal, actually are costing us a lot of time, are creating stress, and are not worth the cost savings. Maybe we gave up 2 hours on a Saturday trying to research the best deal, which ultimately only saves us $100. If we make more than $50 an hour, then objectively it wasn't worth the cost. And the opportunity cost of that time means we could have spent that time with our friends and family, but instead we're glued to our computer screen. So the book, and in my research in general, I'm really trying to help people see that often these minor decisions and major life decisions not only influence our finances, they also impact the way we spend time on an everyday basis.
This reminds me of a conversation I had with Raj Raghunathan, a professor at UT Austin, and an individual who's been researching happiness for several years. He's written the book, If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy? He makes a slightly similar point.
So actually, this is a good context to talk about this one study that came out. It was summarized in an article in the Atlantic magazine. It came out in 2014. And the title of the study, the article was The Secret Fears of the Super Rich. Okay, Secret Fears of the Super Rich. And I believe it was a Harvard study. I'm forgetting who conducted it, but or Princeton study. But basically, they went around interviewing these high net worth individuals. Okay, and in order to qualify as a participant in the study, you needed to have $25 million invested in financial instruments. Right. So this is money that's on the side, so to speak. You know, this is money invested in things like hedge funds or other kinds of financial instruments. Is not counting your house, not counting your cars, not counting your other assets. And they interviewed them to ask them, what are some of your big fears? Okay. And one of the biggest fears that these people had is that they don't have enough money. Okay. So wow. I know it sounds, and it's easy to point fingers at them and say that, you know, I wouldn't be like that. If I had $25 million, you know, I would definitely not be greedy for more money. Okay. But we all know that almost at every stage in our life, we do end up feeling that, you know, hey, you know what, more money might be actually good for me. Okay. And a part of that comes from comparing ourselves to other people. And as you rise up the social ladder, so to speak, the company that you keep changes. And so your comparison point changes too. And whereas when I was in India, for example, you know, having a kind of swimming pool in my own house might have been like something that, you know, was completely out of reach, right? To where I'm living now, I actually don't have a pool in my house, but I do have a hot tub. Okay. But it doesn't seem like that's out of reach at all. Okay. And so definitely seems like, oh yeah, if I had enough money, then maybe I can do that. And I can add maybe a little movie theater in my house. So why should I have to go out and, mingle with the hoi polloi, so to speak? I can just watch these movies in my own home, in the comforts of my home and so on. So your kind of aspirations catch up, right? So that is a very interesting finding that despite having so much money, these people were, feeling that they didn't have enough. They were operating from a scarcity mindset is how I would put it. And then you have the opposite end of the spectrum that is covered in this movie, this documentary called Happy. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it's still available on Netflix and you can watch it. Your viewers, whoever's following this podcast can watch it as well. They start out with a scene in the slums of Calcutta, and the slum dwellers are all people who kind of pull rickshaws, right? You might have seen this. These are not like pulley rickshaws, cycle rickshaws. These are so they're actually literally running around the city with passengers in their in the seat in their back. Sometimes these people are so malnourished that they don't even have they have bones sticking out of there and they don't have enough access to resources to wear shoes. So they're running around, bloody feet, reed thin. And the researchers go to the slums and interview these people because they're very intrigued by this phenomenon where these people don't even have proper homes to live in. They're living in little slums and their homes are basically tarpaulin sheets pulled over four sticks with holes in them so that when it rains, it's leaky and it's like miserable, okay? And yet they're all smiling and if not happy, at least content. And so the researchers are kind of flummoxed by this sight. And so they go and ask them, how can you afford to be content and happy? And I'm paraphrasing what they say, but they basically say something along the lines of, you know what, we're taken care of, okay? We're taken care of and they believe in God or they believe in some kind of a spirit. And they say that whenever we need anything really desperately, we end up getting it. Okay, maybe not in the way that we conceive of it, maybe not immediately, but we end up getting it. And we have a good sense of community. Everybody in the slums takes care of each other. On the days I don't make a good tip, somebody else might make a good tip. And so they feed us. And likewise, we return the favor. And so what to complain about kind of a thing. Okay. So in other words, their life circumstances are characterized by scarcity, right? Not just plain vanilla scarcity, but abject scarcity. And yet they have, if not a mindset of abundance, at least a mindset of contentment. Okay. So no prizes for guessing which of these two groups of people is happier. Okay. In the sense of who needs to take antidepressants just to stay afloat, right? Who needs to pop sleeping pills to fall asleep every night? It's the high net worth individuals. Okay. Very, very interesting finding, right? So what I talk about as an abundance mindset is basically this idea that in your head, you feel that you have more than enough. And it you know, you would think it must be correlated with how much access to resources you actually have, objectively speaking. But in these examples that I just gave you, it appears not to be, okay? And certainly for people like you and me, and for people who are listening to this, I would imagine that most of them have enough access to enough resources that right now it's a question of whether you can kind of convince yourself that you have enough, right? And you can adopt that mindset of abundance. And if you do, you actually end up discovering, and you know, I have to tell you, Deepak, you know, I wasn't somebody who was born with an abundance mindset, or, you know, certainly wasn't nurtured in me. And I had to kind of logically figure this out at some level, you know.
The other way I try and make sense of this insight is that our needs are quite simple and easy to meet, but our wants can be infinite. In the $60,000 to the $100,000 range, we are possibly reasonably content as we are still possibly solving for our needs. But once we cross the $100,000 number, we start paying much greater attention to the wants, and that's a mirage that we can keep chasing to infinity.